This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Railways built during Reconstruction changed the economic landscape of the South, and the turn of the century saw the rise of local manufacturing plants along those railways. Formerly enslaved people and dispossessed farmers provided cheap labor in furniture factories. Now, very few of these factories, at least the early ones, had specialized designers or any experience in woodworking. Affordability was the goal. In Thomasville, North Carolina, a young man rode the wave of furniture manufacturing, and yet, instead of an economic opportunity, he saw an art form and an opportunity to document his travels. Tilden Stone defied the commodity industry and chose to devote his life to building fantastical furniture. And now, for the first time, Tilden's furniture is on display. The Gregg Museum of Art and Design at North Carolina State University tracked down 250 examples of his work for an exhibition, currently on view. And joining me to talk about this work is Roger Manley, museum director and the discoverer of Tilden's work, lead curator of the exhibit. Welcome to the show, Roger. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us about Tilden Stone, because actually how you discovered his work.
Well, the way I discovered his work was some years ago, about 12 or 15 years ago, I was working on a book for a series called the Weird U.S. series. And one of the books they asked me to write was Weird Carolinas. And to get ready to do that book, I sent letters to every small town librarian, every county sheriff, every local historian, every newspaper editor in the state, and said, if there's anything strange in your county, please let me know, because I'm working on a book and I'll plan to come by.
Love to get that letter. Keep going.
Yeah. My mail was really fun for a while. So, I mean, I got all kinds of letters, and yeah, I could go into some of that. But one of the letters was from a librarian in Lincolnton who wrote me and said that she didn't know if this was strange enough to qualify for the book, but there was a house with a large concrete shoe in the front yard. And so I marked it down on my map, and I would do these little 2 or 3 week travels where I'd try to connect the dots, and finally got around to Lincolnton, and sure enough, there was this big shoe sitting in the front yard of this large brick home, sort of a 200-year-old home, and I went up, asked the people if I could take a picture of their shoe. They said, sure, why not? And I went out and started photographing the shoe, and it was a hot day, and after a while, the lady in the house came out and said, you look hot. Would you like to come in and have a glass of iced tea? So I went into the house, and suddenly I saw all this really bizarre furniture all around me, pieces of furniture with dragons climbing on it, or animal heads sticking out of the side and all this. And I thought, well, the shoe is okay, but this is amazing. And so I ended up including some of that, but mostly I just filed it away in my head. And I thought, someday, you know, this really needs to be known. Because when I mentioned it to them, I said, this is really amazing. They said, you think so? I mean, we just grew up with it. It doesn't seem strange to us.
And hey, where's Lincolnton?
Lincolnton is sort of northwest of Charlotte.
All right.
About 40 miles northwest of Charlotte.
So you got this house, and you say, they say, well, geez, nothing strange here. And
yeah,
file it away. So now you go back. And did you ask at all about who at that point, because you were looking for something?
I asked them a little bit about, you know, who did it. And they were happy to show me around. And they said that the husband, it was his uncle who had made it. And they told me the name. And a few years later, I did include a few pieces in a small show I did for the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore, about three examples of his work for a show called Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, because his work was really done in a pursuit of happiness. And I really thought it deserved a full-scale museum show. And
well, now you got a house full of furniture in a house that has this concrete shoe in front. Now, what do you then? And you know who made it? It's a guy named Tilden Stone. Did you find any more?
With the help of that couple, they put me in touch with a number of their relatives, and took me around to visit the relatives. And a lot of the relatives had pieces. Almost Tilden worked for some major furniture companies and even helped found the company that is now Broyhill. But his sort of his day work was making classic, ornate, carved, sort of Victorian-style furniture. But at night, he would come back at 5 o'clock and settle into his little workshop out behind the house and make things just for himself.
And what was the quality of this, of the furniture itself? I mean, you say it's peculiar in some ways, but what about the quality?
The quality is top-notch. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. He had apprenticed to a German, we think, German Black Forest-trained immigrant woodcarver in New York from about 1895 to 1900. He spent 5 years learning the carving trade. And as you mentioned earlier, a lot of these early furniture companies in North Carolina weren't very specialized. They were basically making ladderback chairs and that sort of thing, and, you know, very straightforward North Carolina vernacular furniture in a way. Most of these furniture companies were really cottage industries founded by individual families that would hire a few local people and, you know, they'd make chairs. But Tilden wanted to take it a little bit further, so he went to New York and trained, learned how to really make fine, high-quality, ornate furniture with all the flowers and garlands and cherubs and all that stuff, and figured he would come back to North Carolina and really have a skill that would enable him to kind of top out, you know, in the furniture industry. And he was quite successful for a while.
Well, when did he? Because at a certain point, he takes off for the Seven Seas, right?
Right. I mean, he had been in just before World War One. He had founded a couple of different companies, sold them, you know, found another one, sell it. Had finally gone into business with his brother, who was not a great bookkeeper and some say probably an alcoholic that lost a lot of money for the company. They had a warehouse fire. There were a few financial panics caused by the Sherman Antitrust Act and things like that. And then World War One broke out, and nobody was all that interested in fine furniture while they were fighting the war. So he just went into kind of a economic slump for a while. After the war, he spent a few years trying to make it as a casket maker. Now, you can imagine being a casket maker was not a highly satisfying thing. He would put all this effort into making a really ornate, you know, casket with all the, you know, the trimmings, and then the only people that ever saw it would be crying their eyes out, and then it would be lowered into the ground and covered up with dirt. Yeah. It just wasn't a satisfying, you know, thing for somebody who regarded himself as an artist.
Well, regarded himself as an artist, but as you said, that's not the market for this stuff. There was a migration. People needed chairs. They were furnishing newly built apartments.
Sure.
And he was building all that stuff for his dough and making other stuff that he's given to his nephews, right? So how many people saw the stuff he did?
Not that many, you know. I mean, it just, at some point, I think he just got frustrated with trying to make a dent in it and did something that very few other people would do, is he headed to the West Coast and signed on with a steamship company as a refrigeration engineer, of all things. I don't know what he told them to get the job, but he was hired. And for the next 12 years was at sea with the Dollar Steamship Company on a ship called the President Wilson. And back then, unlike the cruise liners of today, the big ships carried cargo as well as passengers. So they would be in port for quite a while each time while they unloaded. Today's cruise liners pull into port in the morning, the people get off, go shopping for souvenirs, get back on at 5 o'clock or whenever they're told to come back to the ship, and then the ship sails out as they're eating dinner, and the next morning they wake up and they're in a new port. But back then, they would be in port for quite a while. So he had time to go exploring. He would visit local craftspeople. We think he spent some time with probably Chinese furniture carvers, because a lot of his furniture has kind of a Chinese influence. And it also, a lot of the furniture has secrets and puzzles and very peculiar things about it that make it really fascinating.
Yeah, talk about some of those, because the family that you visited was trying to figure out how to get into some of those little secret
compartments. Yeah, I mean, most of his furniture wasn't quite what it seemed. He would make something like a hunting sideboard, you know, the kind of sideboard. But his, unlike the typical example, his would have legs shaped like shotguns and rifles that were carved so exactly they really looked like the real weapons.
And he used also techniques for shadowing and coloring that also added to that, right?
The metal parts looked like metal, although they were carved out of wood. I mean, it really looked like you could just pick it up and fire it, these weapons. But it would have a secret catch, and there would be like a carving of a rabbit, and you'd press the eye of the rabbit, and 3 or 4 feet away, a little panel would pop open, and you'd have to reach into the panel and press on a lever that would open another part of the furniture. You know, things like that.
A real order of operations, too.
One of the pieces of furniture was one that the family had owned since 1944. And had never realized that it had a secret compartment until we went to pick it up to bring it to Raleigh for this exhibition.
Well, talking to Roger Manley of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at NC State, Southern Surreal Masterpiece Furniture from Tilden Stone is showing now until September 8th with guided tours on Fridays, and we've got information at our website. So this is fascinating stuff, but as you say, it's not in wide circulation. It's mostly his family.
Furniture that he probably made is probably all over the country, but this unusual furniture that he made for himself or his family really remained within the family. He had only one, as far as we know, only one outside patron was a guy named James Murphy from Ohio, whose brother owned the Chicago Cubs. And James Murphy was a baseball scout, and somehow in one of his scouting runs, he saw some of that furniture and fell in love with it and began commissioning pieces. Mm-hmm. But as far as we know, that's the only examples of this really bizarre stuff that ever made it outside the family. The rest is all within relatives.
What else do we know about Tilden Stone? Because one of the things we know is he comes back, builds a house for himself, like a steamship, right?
Yeah, back in the 1940s, he decided he was missing life at sea, so he built a house shaped exactly like an old tramp steamer. Had a hull, about 10 feet high, and had a bridge, and the full portholes and all the full looked like a boat. Parked beside the road, just outside of Lincolnton. And that's about the same time that he built the giant shoe, and that was built to entertain his nephew. And
do we know? So how was he doing, and how did the neighbors, sort of take this guy? What did they think of him?
I think he was largely regarded as a crank.
Yeah.
He was known to have a temper. Mm-hmm. One of the pieces we have on display is we call it the Doris Duke telephone stand, because he was commissioned by Doris Duke to make a sort of rotating platform to put a telephone on, and he went to deliver it, and apparently she either didn't admire it enough, or she said something that put him off, and then he said, "The hell with it, you can't have it," put it back on the truck. And drove back, and it's remained in the family ever since. So they call it the Doris Duke telephone stand. So,
yeah. Is that one part of the exhibit? You didn't
yes.
It's oh,
in the ex-
great.
It's so in you the can exhibit with tobacco leaves carved in the base and corn cobs and that sort of thing.
Eccentric life. He was married twice.
Right. And those are pretty funny stories, too. His first wife's name was Rosetta Triplett. And, of course, when she married him, she became Rosetta Stone. Uh-oh. And got really tired of people laughing every time she said her name, so she changed it to Etta.
Okay.
And then the second time he married a woman named Carolyn Poe, whose father's name was Edgar Allan Poe, who was the mayor of Lenoir at the time. So, you can't make this stuff
up. No, it's amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So tell us about some of the other pieces that we'll see at the exhibit.
One of the pieces that everybody really likes is what looks like a bookshelf when you first walk up to it. But if you press a hidden catch and lower the what appear to be the spines of the books, you realize that they're only about a half an inch deep. You just sawed the back off of the books and made a sort of false front with that. So that folds down, and behind it you see a desk with cubby holes and places to put letters, and you assume, most people would assume, well, that's the secret. We've already found, what's the hidden part. But actually, another hidden catch and moving another panel allows you to slide those parts open, and behind that is a bar. This is a piece that he made during Prohibition. He made a number of pieces during Prohibition to hide bottles and drinking equipment, like the glasses and tumblers. And
man,
sort of
in the moonshine state, he could have made a fortune just on that alone.
Well, he might have. You just never know what sort of thing he had going on the side.
Do we know if he made a lot of money or had, especially toward, after he'd returned from sea?
I don't think he was tremendously successful financially.
Yeah.
The second marriage, he lived with his wife's parents, and the four of them shared the house together. I think he put everything he could back into the furniture. He was very particular about using Honduran mahogany for his carving, only the finest wood. We found some letters where he said he was just in knots because he was waiting the next delivery of the precious wood and hoping it would arrive without cracks and things like that.
What do we have? You've got some letters, any diaries? How much do we know about what he was thinking?
There are no diaries. Most of what we've been able to figure out are from newspaper clippings. Small-town newspapers had a way of being a lot more nosy, and back then, they would report when, someone had visitors from out of town or when the kids got an A on the test and that sort of stuff, because they were just craving news. And then also there were thousands of snapshots. He was quite an avid photographer. All these little black-and-white snapshots that show him on all his travels or with his friends. And, by kind of piecing those together, we've been able to sort of figure out a history of his life through that sort of thing.
Does he have, is he a total outsider? Because this is the furniture state, one of the three legs of the economy in this state, certainly in the 20th century. Does he have a place in that story?
I think he was a kind of out on the knife edge of the bell curve of that story. the outsider as that's a field that I know a little bit about. And outsider artists typically are people without training who go out and use whatever materials they can find nearby and just use whatever skills they just happen to acquire. I think he was more conscious than that of being wanting to be a skilled artist and thinking of himself as kind of maybe following in the tradition of great sculptors or something like that, but having to make a living. You couldn't make a living as a Michelangelo in Lenoir, North Carolina back then. So, he would have to make sure that whatever he made was could turn a buck and survive that way.
Roger Manley is the director of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at NC State. Roger, thank you so much for being with us.
Quite, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Southern Surreal, Masterpiece Furniture by Tilden Stone is showing now until September 8th. Guided tours coming up this Friday, weather permitting, and we've got that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Black agriculture in American history gets a second look. We learn how cooperative farming and community gardens provide stability, resistance, and resilience for African American communities. Stay tuned.